have 11 men when you could have 9? It's That's So MLS with myself, Nick Thornton. And with me, as always, is Andrew Bates. Andrew, how are you this week?
I'm doing very well. How are you? After that wonderful weekend.
Great weekend for Canadian soccer teams. Yeah. We'll get to that.
This is a North American soccer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, www.thatsomls.com. Mm-hmm. Before we get rolling, the one thing I wanted to say is we are taping this on a Monday, and I just want to say that my thoughts are with everybody in Toronto as the deadly van incident is taking place. There's not a lot of information out there right now, but I know that a lot of people are worried. I just want to, and I want to put my thoughts out there for the families and everybody affected.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty horrific thing, and I think the news is just sort of coming through in the last couple of hours here on the West Coast. But our thoughts are with everyone. It's a pretty horrific day out there for people.
When you kind of look at the results for Canadian teams, you had a couple, you had kind of three straight lopsided scores, but I think each team kind of found their own way. Last week it was also all three Canadian teams coming up short. This week you all had their own sort of unique ways of going about it. How did you take in the Sporting Kansas City 6? Vancouver 0 game on Friday?
Not well. So collectively, the three Canadian teams gave up 16 goals this weekend.
Wow!
Across three teams. So while they all did crash and burn in their own unique ways, they did have a collective shitting the bed defensively response to the competition. How do I take the Sporting KC Vancouver Whitecaps game?
How did you watch it? How did you watch it? That's what I meant. How did you take it in?
Oh, like literally, how did I even watch it? It's weird. I just turned on my computer and it just started playing. I didn't have to go to any sort of shady mirror websites. It just kind of came up on my computer randomly. It was really odd.
So but perhaps I mean, what was the experience of watching it for you? What did you? How'd that go?
Not well, if I'm honest. I think it was one of those things that probably, like a lot of Whitecaps fans, I was watching this game without a lot of expectation. Oh, I just remembered my other open that I had, which was when the children at Children's Mercy Park aren't showing any mercy at all. It's That's So MLS. Anyway, it's too late for that. We can't go back. Is
a lot of things the Whitecaps would redo if you could go back on
yeah season. If we could only have the redo for them. In the 10th minute, Johnny Russell cuts in and just steps up and cracks one in. I kind of was like, okay, sure, I mean, that'll happen. Like, it's a great goal. Probably somebody should have stepped up, but I say that every week, you say it every week, nobody did. It wasn't a terrible goal to give up. It was a great strike. 6 minutes later, when Johnny Russell does it again, I was like, well, I mean, that's not good to be 16 minutes in, away, and two goals down. But, lots can happen in a short amount of time. And then 14 minutes later, Jimmy Madranda knocks a goal in, which wasn't a great goal. Wasn't great defending, but another great goal. So, honestly, even in that point, I was thinking, this isn't so much the Whitecaps being poor. This is Sporting Kansas City being really good. And we knew that they were going to have a very tough game on their hands, and SKC has been in form. But at that point, I'm going, well, it can't get much worse than this. This is probably game over, but maybe we shift things up a little bit and get back a goal, and we come home with a 3-1 loss to the best team in the West right now. That wouldn't be the worst result. Maybe we could even claw two back. And then there's a little bit of shenanigans that go on. And especially Kendall Waston goes in on Espinoza. When I was watching the game, and in the the replays, it really looks like Waston doesn't actually catch him. And then a big old brawl starts up and his handbags flying everywhere and video review. And in the moment I'm going like, Juarez is clearly off because he basically punches Johnny Russell in the face. Johnny Russell did kind of instigate this, but I don't think it's much of a defense for the Whitecaps to blame him. But I don't, what did you make of that whole, whatever that was?
Well, I kind of tried to take the long approach as I did in my column for Little Rubber Pellets. I don't want to be the type of person who's coming into this being, I feel like there is some very common responses from fans about a lack of ambition or a lack of you know, poorly picked tactics. I don't want to go, it's weird. I said it was sort of a quick trip to rock bottom. Yeah. And I don't want to necessarily, I feel like when Carl Robinson usually says, I don't want to talk about formations, or he did a lot last year, it's because, you know, the particulars between a 4-4-3 and a 4-4-2 diamond or whatever else are, you know, sometimes hard to make out from an armchair quarterback position. But I think that the using the 3-5-2 was sort of another, like a final straw on the camel's back that stretches back to the Parker Felipe trade.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked a little bit about how Felipe and Juarez don't really fit in the same midfield together. Mm-hmm. And I also think that, you know, they just had so many preparations. They were talking all the time in the preseason about using the 3-5-2, and they never did. The only other game they ever used it in was against Atlanta when it was a 4-1.
That didn't go well either.
That's right. Robinson said that today. He said, in my two games, we've given up 10 goals in the two games I used the 3-5-2, so not a great decision, huh? He was quoting as being said by a hard journalist. And I think that the kind of acute failure that you had, Waston, I don't think Waston has looked super great this season in general, but mm-hmm. I think when you shove all three players into the center back position, as the 3-5-2 kind of requires you to do, Waston has a lot of burden of trying to make sure that people are in the right positions. Like, he, on the second goal, him and Nowinski are overlapping. And then
Nowinski didn't play.
Oh, not Nowinski. I should change my article then. How about that? Whoever was on the right side on the 3-5-2. Aha. They overlapped a little bit. I felt that the other thing on that first one. So in the 3-5-2, the wingbacks are supposed to come back, so you essentially have your five defenders, right?
Yes.
And then you have two defensive midfielders. So essentially you're committing seven players into the attack. Mm-hmm. Well, in that first goal, all five players are back, and the only players that are in the distance where the ball is being sent are Gasol and Felipe. And Gasol is caught way out of position and tries to bust his lungs to cross over because Felipe is watching the action at a trot.
Yes. Because he's not a defensive midfielder.
Yes. They pull them out. They flatten them all out wide, and then they send they completely expose the central midfielders in that first goal.
And this is where this is where this formation breaks down. And I don't think it's the formation that necessarily lost them the game, but, you know, typically you'd think in a 3-5-2 or whatever system, three at the back, where you stand to be caught is on the counter and being overloaded on the wings. But where the goals were coming from, for the most part, except for, I believe, Madranda's, which is, again, kind of a bit of a wonder strike that he was left wide open, but he's quite far out and just hits it perfectly at a very tight angle. But they're actually kind of playing through the middle, which you'd think would be the strength of a 3-5-2, is because really there should be five guys in the middle in front of that ball, and yet somehow there's really only two.
Well, the critique of the 3-5-2 on the Madranda goal is that Madranda is hitting from 35 yards out, and there's six Whitecaps standing in a line at 20 yards.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, and it, again, regardless of formation, defensively, where are people stepping up and putting some pressure on these balls? We know the kind of quality that Sporting Kansas City has. We know what kind of results they're capable of at home. They've clearly solved their goal-scoring problems from last year. And they just kind of ran away with it. I'm interested, what do you think of two players being sent off at once? It's very clear in that scuffle that it's quite clear towards the end of it, even on first watching, that Juarez basically softly punches Johnny Russell in the face and is probably going to get a red for that.
Yeah.
And then video review, Reyna also goes off. And Johnny Russell somehow escapes with a yellow card, despite him sort of instigating the entire thing. What do you make of this? Was it two sendings off? Was it a foul in the first place? Did Waston kind of instigate because he's yelling at Espinoza to get up off the ground? Like,
gotta put this on happened? Waston. Gotta put this on Waston. Because I think that as much as everybody comes in, I haven't really gone back since the game to look at it. I do kind of think that Waston does catch him, Espinoza. I think it was a foul. And partially I was ready to buy this at the time just because I was so disgusted with what was going on the Whitecaps side. But I still kind of buy this, that we've seen Waston as a great leader. He became like a really sort of unlikely scoring star at the end of last season. He's had a season before where he was constantly being cautioned and sent off. He was not, his potential was not being realized. And then last year he was the leader and the player that we all recognize him to be. I think that this was a little of a flash of the old Waston, in that he takes this foul and he's already had a bad game. He got lit up on the second goal. And he he's mad at Espinoza because he thinks that the foul is soft. I don't know if he's mad at himself for just getting into a shitty situation.
When you're 6'4", standing over Espinoza, who's still on the ground, screaming into his face, I kind of can understand where Johnny Russell sprints 30 yards to get in his face.
Absolutely.
And shove him away. Now, I do think that it's kind of surprising that Russell gets away with just a yellow card, and I think it's surprising there hasn't been follow-up disciplinary action. But that might have been one of the things that they're looking at. Is, to me, it's actually kind of Waston that starts the whole thing by getting into Espinoza's face after fouling him. And I watched it again today, and he does clip him. It looks very soft, but there's clear contact. I think Waston probably knew that. And like you said, Waston's frustrated because he just got lit up. And so tempers flare. And also, the Whitecaps are looking to their captain to set the tone. So Waston flies off the handle, and then you get everybody rushing in and doing the same. If there should have been any confrontation, it should have been between Russell and Waston, and it should have been left at that. There's no need for Juarez or Reyna to come flying in out of nowhere. But you have a thing to say, so I'm going to leave it there.
Let me tell you a little story. This is kind of what I laid out in my column, but I really do, I think that this is a real way to explain how we got here, is that in the off season, and this is why people are now talking about the culture of the club. You have so much turnover. You lose a bunch of players. Montero was maybe not always central to the club, but Harvey was, and Ousted was, Bolaños was. you turn over so much in a club that already has a history of sort of letting people walk. And in the case of Ousted, letting people walk for financial reasons. As much as... So you've got all this turnover, and it becomes a little sad. But at the same time, people have got to move on. And you have a preseason that is kind of okay, I thought. I thought that things were looking good at it. They kept talking about the 3-5-2, but they never used the 3-5-2 during preseason, except for one half of one of the preseason games. And then... 3 days before the season, they trade Parker for Felipe, which forces you to find something to do for Felipe, which we've talked about as being an issue. And it also forces you to put either Aaron Mond or Aja in a starting role. And here it was Aja. And I think they've both of them have been serviceable at best in terms of the actual starter that you want to go with as your starting central midfielder. I don't think that... The Whitecaps had the chance to make that choice. Mm-hmm. It was foisted upon them. But it started okay. This is what... We can't overstate this enough. This is the worst game in Whitecaps MLS history.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a worse one. The previous
club been worse teams, but there hasn't been a worse loss.
And this is what's interesting. Is that it's not... There have been definitely been worse seasons so far. But this is not rock bottom in the middle of despair, right? This was everything fell off the wheels so quickly. And part of the reason why it didn't fall off the wheels right away is because Kai Kamara has been very good.
Yeah.
He in the midst of this loss of culture, loss of continuity, you have Kai Kamara creating leadership. He scored 3 times. The Whitecaps have won in every game that he scored in. They have not won in any other games. And he's been, he's helped to generate success. And he was not there last week. He was there for the loss against RSL. So the Whitecaps are coming into their third game on a 2-game losing streak. They've lost Kamara, which was the kind of the thing that was holding everything together. And they literally switched to this untested 3-5-2 formation that piles everything on a Kendall Austin. Literally, he's at the center of the 3-5-2. Everybody's relying on him. He doesn't have the game that maybe he needs to have, but he was put in that position.
Yeah.
And the Whitecaps really relied on him to, without Kamara to bolt everything together, it was like the end of last season. Now Austin will bolt everything together, and then he just didn't. I'm shocked he ended the game on the pitch.
It is kind of shocking, isn't
it? Watching that whole thing, I was surprised he wasn't sent off. And I was surprised that he ended the game on the pitch. Now, the rest of it, what can you say? It sucked. You're playing with 9 players against a team that's good. Marinovic saves the penalty. This is what's like the record for winning margin is 7. And it could have been 9 because yes. Marinovic saves the penalty. And then there's 2 more good chances in the second half that aren't goals.
Yeah, I agree. It's kind of remarkable looking back that Waston wasn't sent off at the scuffle and a couple of other times or that he was able to sort of calm himself down. And it's a very thankless job to be on the pitch at that point. I mean, you're 3-0 down away from home, and then you have 2 players sent off. I was almost like, mate, just head for the tunnel. Like, just pack up and walk away and take a forfeit at this point, like, rather than risk injury. Like, what are you really going to get out of this?
Well, Kendall was on a yellow before that happened.
Yeah, I know. Like, yeah, I think he got kind of lucky there, too. I think it was the resulting scuffle and the idiocy from Juarez and Reyna that almost made Waston's thing look dull in comparison. I didn't even see it upon replays until today when I went back to look at it, that because I wasn't quite sure why Reyna, besides getting in the middle of the scuffle, why he was sent off.
It said that he did a little kick.
He grabs Russell around the neck and body slams him to the pitch.
Too much.
And Reyna gets like, again, for both Juarez and Reyna, it's just like there's absolutely no need to even get involved. And just the lack of discipline and the immaturity from both of them. And I know Juarez isn't going for Russell's face, but he's way out. There's already a guy clamoring after him. He doesn't need to get involved. They both do. And then they both get sent off, and rightfully so.
So you're frustrated. I guess that's what it comes down to, is that Juarez, not particularly. I think that Juarez has had a mainly anonymous season.
Mm-hmm. And when he's been good, he's been good. He's a great passer of the ball, and he's very creative. But he clearly he's got a discipline problem. He loses his cool way too quickly, and in this league, mm-hmm. it's just not going to fly.
So I was very taken by the fact that people were. So this is where people come down to. This criticism of Carl Robinson. I don't necessarily think it's all Robinson's fault. I don't necessarily think it's all the club's fault, but I do think it's a combination of those two things.
I agree.
Because people joked, I think it was Mike Martinago that said, Mike Martinago, who said that, what could we do? Who said had a bet on whether or not fine lines was going to come up in the press conference in his interviews, and it definitely did. Here's what he said. Obviously, there's 5-minute moments in games. We started off very well, fairly even first 15 minutes. Then we concede, and we're three nothing down in 40 minutes. An incident then changes the game. We lose emotional control, and we had two players sent off. Later in the thing. He says, you know, fine lines. The game's about fine lines. Which one? Yeah. What one moment is the moment that is, oh, we totally could have won this game if we didn't concede three times. We totally could have won this game if we didn't. By the time people get sent off, the team's already losing 3-0. It's gone. It's already over.
Yeah. No, I completely agree, and part of my frustration, and I think many people's frustration with Robinson right now, is his response to things. That they just lost two games in a row. They're going away on the road. They don't have Kai Kamara. You play a relatively untested system that leaves you incredibly vulnerable at the back with a bunch of players who don't yet have team chemistry. And then... you know, the players, it's up to them to keep their heads and not do silly things to get sent off. But, and then after the game to say, well, we handled it for the first 15 minutes, we looked like the better team. It's like, no, Reyna had one chance in the first few minutes. We didn't look like we were in it at any point after that. We were out of this game 10 minutes in, really, at least in terms of pressure, in terms of intensity, in terms of creativity. So the response is not good enough.
That first goal comes on 9. Mm-hmm. You know, he's out there saying, you know, 15 minutes. And I understand this is for the public. Like this is not necessarily what he's saying. This is not necessarily what he's saying in the locker room. But he's on... this is not necessarily what he's saying in the locker room, but he's on 15 minutes... But it's like 9. And he keeps saying, oh, it's 15 minutes. We had people sent off, you know, well, I guess 40 was correct. This idea that the game started really well, you don't get any points for having a first 10 minutes that you don't score a goal in, you know?
No, and I think this is going to be a series of mounting pressures on Robbo to come up with a little bit better of a response. And, of course, as you said, it's a public... interview, you know, and you can piss off the fans all you want. Ultimately, you win a few games and you'll be back on their side. But this, to me, from start to finish, was just really poor decision making from him. And I think, you know, I know enough about MLS to know he's not going to get sacked over a couple of bad results. But I do feel like this is the game that's probably put him on watch. And I imagine there's probably some discussion now of, you know, the Whitecaps are not a money-making organization. They're not a money-spending one, but they also have been losing money basically every year since they've joined MLS. And to have another mediocre season and potentially lose a bunch of ticket sales because you don't have a big name and because you're not winning games, sooner or later that's going to be taken into account. Now, I think there's a great amount of faith put in Rabo, but this one I feel like, you know, he's going to be on watch. And unless things turn around significantly, I do think it's entirely possible that he's gone by the summer. I don't think it's likely, but I think that he really has to get some response out of his team and also stick to what he's good at, you know? Like, as much as we get frustrated by the sort of the bunker and counter style of play, that's what won them the game last time in Sporting KC. Why mess with that system?
Yeah.
You know, like, okay, put Blondell on instead of Hurtado at first. I'm totally fine with that. I'm not saying you use exactly the same setup or lineup, but you're using an untested and as of yet unsuccessful model for formation. And clearly players don't know how to adjust to it. So it's not just about the formation. It's about, are players comfortable in that formation? And they were just left so, so exposed. I really don't think there's much more that you can say about this game other than they have to do everything so much better. Like, there's no one fine lines. It's all the lines. We are so off of the lines. There was, besides the Marinović penalty save, there's nothing about this game that is positive. There's nothing to take away from this where you can say, hey, well, you know, well, at least Breck Shea touched the ball one time. Like, it was bad. And of course, after the sending off, they looked completely defeated, and I don't blame them because they were. But, you know, Sporting KC just pops in three easy goals with basically the Whitecaps chasing after them as they do it.
Yeah, this is the thing. There's no universe where that goes well. It's not a string theory. It's not a string theory thing where, you know, you flip the coin and you lose 6-0. I know that in every sport you'll sometimes get routed and it's just not your day and you've got to pick up afterwards. This is not a mystery. No. Why this happened, you know, and this is ultimately, I said this in the piece. This is what I feel like the problem right now, if anything, between the way that the Whitecaps and the fans communicate, it's this push and pull where, and I say this all the time, is it's okay to defend your strategy, but then if your strategy doesn't work, you have to say, our strategy didn't work. Like, yeah. In you have this push and pull between the fans and the Whitecaps where people say, our spending isn't good. And then they say, oh, our spending is great. You know, we're not signing great players. They say, oh, you just don't know how great the players we signed are. That was an awful game. Oh, it could have gone well. You know, like.
Wait, did you see the first 9 minutes, though? Because those were, come on.
Listen. We may have scored, we may have conceded 6 times and had 2 people sent off and conceded a penalty.
Maybe they'll just start selling special ticket packages where you just pay a little less and you just get to watch the first 9 minutes.
It's like you look at Sports Illustrated has this MLS Ambition Rankings 2018, which you know it's well timed to our discussion of ambition. When you look at the way that the club now, that more interesting than the actual rankings in which the Whitecaps placed 14th. Mid-table, as ever. Lower to the end. Almost more interesting is they also printed the questionnaires. And what I find interesting about the way that the club chose to communicate with Sports Illustrated about this is this sort of obfuscation where everything... Like, and I understand that it's not a rocket science to... You know, accentuate the negatives, hide the positive, or accentuate the negatives, hide the positive. Accentuate the positives, hide the negatives. Right? I get that, but at the same time, when you listen to how they talk about it, it's like, how would you rate your investment in DPs? And they say we've spent $12 million on DPs in the last 3 years. Our DPs are Kendall Waston and Breck Shea. Now, what they don't say is that they've got an open DP spot that they just don't don't fill. They defend their record of using TAM to try and get more players over the maximum salary charge, which is kind of how the they get around that. But I mean, like the point of using TAM to hide players as not DPs is to then have space to hire DPs.
Yeah.
The other thing is, and I don't know what they, how they rank. I don't know how these, because it's like a questionnaire. It was since 2015, we have spent approximately $12 million on DP salaries and transfer fees. And then, so the TAM, the DP players are Waston and Shea. The TAM players are Blondell, Gasol, Juarez, Kamara, Reyna, and Teixeira. Is what they say. But they don't. They don't leave in this point that I think people are focusing on, that the DP spots are not, as other teams use them, to denote the team's best players, right? We don't use them to sign stars. We put whatever player we have that costs the most money in those positions, and we don't even fill all those positions. The other thing that was hilarious to me in this response is, do you have a USL and or NWSL team? If so, what are the operating and salary budgets for that team? And the first answer is, we are excited to enter the first year of our new USL affiliation with Fresno FC.
Yeah.
Not noting they closed a club to do it.
Yeah, it does kind of smack a little bit of like, you know, and I don't think the Whitecaps are in serious financial trouble, but the story they're not talking about is that they are losing money. And basically, they're looking to make that up through advertising and ticket sales. It's interesting to think how they're going to do that if they can't win games or build some excitement around the club. And as much as I don't think the Whitecaps should go out and spend $10 million on one player that's going to maybe score 12 goals in a season, those players also put a lot of bums in seats and sell a lot of merchandise. And if you can find the right balance of those things to ensure that, A, you're performing at levels where people want to come see you play, but also just be having some excitement around the club and a name that people want to come see, that comes and pays back. But the Whitecaps ownership group just seems to be so reluctant to take any risks that I think it's actually riskier to continue playing it safe. Yes, they've made some great signings and they've done, you know, some good bits of business. But you're right. At this point, it's a club without an identity, and it's a club that really doesn't seem to have any ambitions other than like we're gonna go out and try to win as many games with what we have. Like, all right, well, see you possibly in the last playoff spot, but maybe not.
Well, the thing about the identity thing that's the most galling is that it isn't even in style of play, because as much as, you know, having a soak up defense and go on the counter style isn't always the most exciting style. You know, we got us to interesting places last year. The problem with culture and the problem with identity is that we keep selling our fucking players. Like, that's the issue. The issue is not as much as you see Fernando Torres is interested in going to the MLS, he's interested in going to four teams, and the Whitecaps are never on that list. Or very rarely on that list. As much as you want it, you'd love to be a part of these, you know, big, huge deals. The issue is that they have basically at no point since 2011 thought anything of dumping a player that was not worth it to them for sporting or financial reasons, no matter what.
Yeah, I agree.
And doing it in some cases in terms of the Alan Rochot thing, as you know, and not caring how they do it at all.
Yeah. Well, there are other games we need to talk about, unfortunately.
I did promise on Twitter that our review of this game would just be 5 minutes of uncontrolled weeping, so this is pretty close.
It's pretty good. It said it's 35 It says 35 minutes of measured anger, which if we're upset in here in Vancouver, I can't imagine that folks in Montreal are feeling much happier about their result.
That was so rough. That was so rough.
Three goals from Piatti in the first half. And you think, shit, Montreal's got this one in the bag. Finally. Finally.
And against as we've talked LAFC about... LAFC, too. You don't expect that of LA,
No, but we have seen LAFC give up a lot of goals, and we know that they have defensive issues, and Montreal seemed to capitalize perfectly on that. And then LAFC just tears them a new one, and oh boy, did things get bad real quick. I mean, Lawrence Simon did get a goal back for them to make it 2-1 in, I believe, the 25th minute. Mm-hmm. Then Piatti scored another one. It's like, okay, it's 3-1 going into the half. Maybe LAFC gets another one. Maybe Montreal gets another one, but it looks in the bag. 52nd minute, Phil Heller gets a goal. Then an own goal. Mm-hmm. Then Carlos Vela. There's a penalty kick in the 83rd minute. And just to top things off in the 89th minute, Latif Blessing gets another goal. And somehow what started out as a 3-1 likely victory for Montreal and a very crucial victory somehow turns around is 5-3, another 8-goal game.
A lot of weird PKs in this game. I felt that the third goal in particular, there was a complete lack of defensive organization.
From either team.
For either team. No, but on that one specifically, right? Like, that's the one that I really catch. And I think this is one of those games where you have... It was strange to me to look at the LA equalizer, which was the sixth goal in the game, and realize how much time there was still left. Because again, for some reason, this match was blacked out of MLS Live and not featured on TSN because it was only on TBS for some reason. When Raitala, and he's had a rough season, scores the Montreal's Raitala scores the own goal. It's 57 minutes. I think it's great to go up two goals early, and it's not. This is not a most dangerous lead joke, but like everything, so much was front loaded and they just weren't able to just LA was in, maybe this is a credit to Coach Bob Bradley, was completely able to re-energize and make their gameplay work in the second half.
Yeah. It's so hard to even think of what to say about this match, really, beyond we've talked a lot about Montreal's lack of pace and lack of pressure. And for 30 minutes, you're like, oh, this is exactly how you need to play. Run things through Piatti and move into space, move towards the ball, like basics. Like, you guys can do this. You're a good team, I swear. And then it's like they just forgot? Against arguably one of the crispest, fastest teams in MLS right now that's coached extremely well. And I, as good as LAFC was in this game, I really feel like Montreal handed it to them of just like the fight has got to be there. And it just looked all too easy at that point. As you said, there's just the amount of time players had on the ball to think about what they were going to do was a pretty poor showing.
Well, if we are looking at this year as sort of like a first chapter under Remy Gard, this is going to be one of those things that maybe you look back later and be like, well, here's a masterclass in how not to concede. Here's a masterclass in how not to, give up your 3-1 lead.
Yeah.
If it's a young team, if we're talking about this is a young team that's learning things, this is a lesson, I guess.
The difference to me about this game is not just that, okay, they scored goals and didn't get completely blown out of the water like the Whitecaps, but as you said, Montreal's in a transition period and it's a project for them. And that even though, yes, it's Piatti who gets the three goals, is this is one where you go, for the first 30 minutes, Montreal did look good, and in some cases looked like the better side, and things are starting to click for that team. So the difference between them and the Whitecaps for me is that Montreal, I think, over the course of the season will continue to improve. I'm at this point, I would say playoffs look like a bit of a distant hope, but I'm not even sure that that's necessarily their goal at this point, is it's to build some sort of a core in the team and hopefully as well bring in somebody who can be the eventual heir apparent to Piatti, because who knows how much gas he has left in the tank, although after this weekend, I'd say a bit.
If this is Star Wars: A New Hope, is Piatti like Obi-Wan Kenobi? Is he gonna get like sent off at the end of the movie?
Sent off? No, I think he's just gonna disappear. Somebody will slice him the corner flag, and he'll just crumble into his jersey. But overall, I thought it's a very, very disappointing result for Montreal, and they have to be better. But I do think that they can learn a lot from this. And they did put up a good fight, at least for a little while, against a very, very, very good side. Then you've got the weird situation that continues to unfold for Toronto FC, in that Greg Vanney gives no fucks about MLS right now. And that's very clear. So, and we talked about that last week. We talked about the week before. Clearly, Greg Vanney is very content to just try players out. Like, this is preseason for them. They're focusing everything on the CCL final. I would have thought that perhaps that final looking a little bit unlikely, he might have been like, you know what, Houston, we can probably beat them. Let's put a bit of a stronger side on. He did not do that.
No.
And boy, oh boy, did Houston make them pay. 5 goals. Toronto did get 1. So shout out to Mitchell Tainter, who I think the day before was signed from a USL side on a loan. Wow. Yes, he's from Sacramento. He's the only person that scored for Toronto. And really, it was kind of all one-way traffic. Toronto had a few chances and a couple of moments that they looked somewhat of a threat. But for me, the standard of this match is that Houston wins 5-1 and also has 5 different goal scorers. And Houston's strength this season really seems to be in the depth and ability to... You know, Albert Elise has kind of been a little bit slow to start, as has Manotas and Kyoto. But by committee, they've been very, very good. And when you've got 5 players on the pitch who can score goals, if your strikers aren't necessarily making it happen, and Elise had a number of chances, that's great to see. And I don't know, if you're Greg Vanney, what are you taking away from this match or these matches up to this point?
I had commented before that it was, you know, such a strange way they chose to go about it. In terms of, like, I think last, it was like one player between the America match and the Colorado match. It was like only one player in the starting 11, and then a difference. And then like maybe just 3 or 4 in the 18 altogether. And when you look at it, it's like they heard that criticism and they were like, oh, you didn't want us to play Drew Moore.
Yeah.
We don't have to.
The one player with experience is like, fuck them. Take them off. They did play Ricketts.
Ricketts didn't start in against Chivas.
No, but I'm saying, like, they did have a player on the field with some experience.
Right, but I just mean in terms of, like, if you're looking at it as an A side, B side sort of situation, the only similarity between the two teams was, and I can never get his name right, Echeteke.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the only player that played, in both games, and he was a sub in the CCL game. You're right to say that I wondered about it, but I mean, this is the harder trip in terms of which one you want to put less of a focus on. And they certainly did put less of a focus on this one. You can't, they've been on this train for some time though. And you kind of wonder how long you could wait to start the season. And like, It's yeah. been lucky for them that they these two games have come against Western Conference sides. So they come in and they come in and drop a gift to teams. Well, maybe Houston. Houston's been doing a little bit better, but in as a result, Houston as a team that has a chance of contending gets a gift of 3 points from Toronto.
Totally. But, you know, I do think Vanny's got his eye on the long game. And here's the thing. Yes, we've asked, how long do you take to warm up and get your season going? At this point, though, I think it's very clear that all Toronto's looking at is like, look, if we get into the playoffs, hopefully we're hitting our stride by then and we're in form. There's no reason why they couldn't storm through the playoffs and take it again and sort of be this dark horse through the season. Also looking at their schedule, regardless of what happens on Wednesday in the final, which I feel like is sort of a foregone conclusion, but you never know. The next match they play is 3 days later at home against Chicago Fire, who, although they won this weekend, has not looked great.
Yep.
Followed by a match against Philadelphia Union, who's also not looked great. Seattle Sounders at home. Like, they've got three home games in a row against teams that have struggled this season. And then they go away to New England. So there's four matches. They're also, I believe, they've got two games to make up in a short amount of time. So it's conceivable that if they pull out, you know, if they can get 9 points out of those 12 even, which at this point might sound ambitious, but if a team can do it, I believe it's Toronto. All of a sudden, they're back in the mix with all the other teams. So I think that this is a calculated risk by Vanny, and it might seem a little naive given the perhaps very small chance that they actually win the Champions League final. But they don't need to win the Supporters' Shield, and I don't think they have any designs on being best in the East this year. Mm-hmm. They're going to try to build a team that can win. Now Vanny has had a really good look at his sort of B squad and even some of his C squad. Wow. And knows players that he can call on for depth. I mean, I'm not joking. I think he's been very crafty at that. And yeah. The big gamble will be is if they can't start getting some results in May, it is going to be a bit of a mountain to climb, because once they make up those games, if they can't get some crucial points out of those, then they could be crawling uphill in what has become a very, very competitive Eastern Conference. And they could really be fighting for a playoff spot.
Yeah, the teams that have played the most have played eight games. So TFC has three games in hand on those clubs. So
yeah, which again, that's potentially 9 points.
Puts them in 12th, which would have them be fourth. Nobody else collects. It's frustrating. It's frustrating, but also it has something to do with the schedule too, because they got an easier. It's as much as they completely dunked these, as much as they opened, used their foot, put it on the lever of the garbage, and threw these two games right in the garbage.
Yeah.
That was. They also didn't have to play as many. Like they were able to get through this area without having to. With a much lighter schedule, which again was not afforded to the Whitecaps when they were playing the same teams in the same competition last year.
Well, and what was the stat for, and this is in no way an excuse, but it's just an interesting note, is I think as of Friday, they've traveled something like 22,000 kilometers so far this season.
And I would walk 500 miles. that should be the new song.
It should be, except add a few zeros onto the end of that. One of the surprising results for me that came out of this weekend was Chicago got on the board and won a game against what's been a at times inconsistent but overall a fairly strong New York Red Bulls.
That was a very interesting game.
Somehow came out of there with 3 points.
That one came back and forth a few times. I think that there were two games, and this is one of them, where it seemed from the highlights at least that the two teams were well matched and maybe had not really found a good way to get past each other, and then a penalty made all the difference and sort of unlocked. Am I correct about this? In this one? Or any of these on... There was a penalty, but maybe it was not... Right, so we have the Katai goal.
A little soft.
Right, okay, so we've got the Alexander Katai goal, which was beauty.
Yeah.
A really, really beautiful goal from the top of the box off of a clearance. This was not one of the ones that was nil-nil until that happened. But Robles then fouls Katai and concedes the goal to put Chicago up 2-0.
And I thought they were very lucky to keep Robles on the pitch. I think they were a little bit kind to him there. I actually thought that should have been a sending off for him. Because he just comes out and cleans out the feet of the attacker. To me, you're awarding a penalty from your goalkeeper coming out and sweeping out the feet, denying a clear goal-scoring opportunity. The rules say that should be a red. Mm. But, yeah.
Well, this is the fire that is successful, is the fire that moves around the ball a lot and is able to rotate through the skills of various parts of the team.
Mm-hmm. On the less interesting side of things, we had Columbus and New England trading goals to come away with a 2-2 draw. These are two teams that we talked about in the early parts of the season as being ones to watch. And for me, this is a pretty good result for New England. What do you take from this one? And on the road as well for New England. What do you make of this? Is this just a whatever shrug they shared a point? Or what do you make of it?
The first half was exciting. I think Columbus has stepped off a little bit of the from where they entered the season. We continue to watch New England each week get more and more familiar with each other, and we continue to watch Teal Bunbury get more and more confident. Bunbury had a fantastic no look shot on his first goal, where he takes the pass with his ball to with his back to the goal, and turns around and fires it into the back net, seemingly with no knowledge of where anyone was behind him. Just great to see.
And he struggled. Is it just me? Like, he struggled quite a bit last year. I thought that, you know, I can't remember. I thought he got at least one red card and was part of that sort of debacle towards the end of New England's season. But he's come back completely refocused. And, I mean, he's always, I think, been a player that's been okay. But he really seems to have kind of stepped things up a different level. And he's not necessarily somebody I associate with being a real game changer. But
he's not somebody I took much notice of last year.
No, or somebody that you necessarily think is going to score that kind of goal. He's sort of, to me, has always sort of seemed like kind of a lumbering forward kind of midfielder that more often than not is just in the way and causing problems because he's so damn big and built like a linebacker, but not because of necessarily his skill. But he certainly put that into perspective this season.
So I would say that the big deal here, sort of the story of it was, it all took place kind of in the first half. For me, at least seeing from the, again, I didn't get to see the game. I was looking at the highlights, but, to look at the fact that Columbus sort of lucked out on their first goal early, with a miscommunication on the back line resulting in an own goal. They didn't really seem to get anything of note together until Sardes scores in the 43rd. So once things settle in, they're able to get that lead. They don't leave the half with the lead. they weren't really able to make things happen, and nobody did, despite a pair of pretty good chances quite late in the game for each side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I actually thought this game didn't have a ton in it for me to really take away. I thought Higuain was lucky to not get sent off for a nasty little elbow that he sent. But I think it's a fair result, and if anything, perhaps it makes sense that two teams that we've pegged as kind of beginning to put something together come out with a 2-2 draw. And I guess maybe the takeaway from this is at least it wasn't 0-0. And Zardes continues to find a way for him to bag goals. I believe this is his fifth of the season for Columbus, so it's great to see him back on the scoreboard. Yeah, not too much to take away from this one. Except a little bit disappointing from Zach Steffen. I feel like his defenders let him down a little bit, but he's had a rough start to the season, and I hope that doesn't shake his nerves too much, because he's such a fantastic young goalkeeper, but he just seems a little bit a step behind in the last couple of games, or not quite there.
You did see that he had one nice save on the sort of push save against Teal Bunbury.
Yep.
Other than that, you know, it's a...
It's I forgot to talk about Houston's goalkeeper. Shout out to Sanchez. My God. He had like three incredible saves in that match, but...
Indeed. In the past, Steffen has been sort of the difference between success and failure. And in this case, he was able to come up with a couple of key saves, but you didn't get the idea that he was, you know, the reason why they were still in the game by any by any stretch. Once Columbus finally started to get firing again. One of the games that I was thinking of in terms of two teams that really didn't have anything going on until the penalty was Dallas-Philadelphia. in which Dallas looked pretty frustrating. Like they had two amazing passing moves, including one that just looked stupid good. Like stupid how many passes they were, very pretty short passes they were able to put together, but they had nothing. They both two really good passing moves resulted in shots right at the goalkeeper from close range. And it really looked like an opportunity for Philadelphia to score. They certainly hadn't scored when CJ Sapong cheekily sort of dug it up past the back line. There was not a chance. I understand that it's just muscle memory. You hit it, you hope that it was right. So Philadelphia looked like it had a chance. And then good old Trusty. Good old Trusty for Philadelphia. Surname is Trusty. His first name is, I'm not sure off the top of my head. Austin Trusty. Wow. Okay, I was saying that PC was my name of the league, but this might be my new name of the league.
Well, and remarkably too, as well as, you know, a rough night out for him, but two teenagers starting at center back for Philadelphia, Mark McKenzie being the other, Philadelphia struggling a little bit with injuries. So, you know, Philadelphia has struggled. I think defensively they've looked quite good this season and continue to be a team that has some potential and maybe doesn't quite always live up to it. But, you know, a Dallas team that struggled so much last season didn't make a ton of off-season moves, which, Carl Robinson, take note, you don't need to sell everybody when things don't go right, are unbeaten.
Yeah, that's true.
One of the final two teams
they
left.
They could, yeah. The other game where we had this this deadlock was RSL versus Colorado, which had the just early on the big whoopsie from Tim Howard. Colorado is getting lit up It stretched. They're totally stretched by a passing move that forces him to come off his line and challenge at the. And he just keeps on challenging past the edge of the 22-yard box, and gets sent off on 20 minutes at 0-0.
And what's your take on? Sorry, I cut you off right as you were saying it.
Yeah. What's your take on? I was going to say that I had no idea that Zach McMath was Colorado's backup goalkeeper. it shocked me that he was as good. For a long time in that game until the penalty, he was as good as you know any starting keeper I could name in the league. Right, like he turned in a great performance.
Which. And I'm glad you brought that up because to me, he's kind of the star of the match in a way. It's unfortunate for Howard. I've watched it a lot and yeah, it's hard to say. It does look a bit like the ball strikes his forearm and then hits his chest, but it's really hard to see. So I'll assume VAR was correct in that. And it's just unfortunate from Tim Howard. Obviously he's not prone to really making mistakes, but probably the right decision.
So it wasn't a handball. He played the ball outside the area.
But with his hand.
I thought
you can't handle the ball out of your area.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you think... right, yes.
Because he goes sliding in. That's not the problem. The issue is the ball strikes his arm and then comes off his chest.
Oh, totally, no!
Totally accidental, and I think probably... I can imagine probably the only time it's ever happened in Tim Howard's career... But it's just one of those unfortunate things. But on replay, it's kind of like you sort of have to give that.
All of his forwards in the history of time are now saying, "See, this is what we mean."
Yeah.
All of his defenders.
Yeah.
Now you understand.
The
pain of intentional handball.
But I'll say this for Colorado is that they last 82 minutes. Mostly on the back of Zach McMath, which shout out to the backup goalkeepers who you never hear about, you never think about until you need to, who are warming up in the wings and maintaining focus. And you just think about all the training and all that goes into it. And you sit there week in, week out, especially if you're starting behind Tim Howard, knowing that you're probably not going to play unless something like this happens. And he came out and had a fantastic match. And I don't think any of the three goals that went past him were at all his fault. You're right, he had a fantastic game. And in the 82nd minute, they give up a bad penalty, and it's kind of all downhill from there. But I would actually say for Colorado, this one is like kind of one you just have to take on the chin and go back to what you're doing well. But the thing I'll say about this, and I don't know if you agree or not, is that this did not look like the type of Colorado Rapids loss that we saw so much last season. This looked like an unfortunate thing that happened, and they fought as hard as they could with 10 men, and obviously just didn't quite have that extra bit of oomph. But on another night, you know, they can hold out for an extra, you know, 7 or 8 minutes and get a point out of something with only 10 men on the pitch.
Give the credit to Albert Rusnak, whose free kick goal to seal the game away was very, very pretty. The kid can play. Zach McMath, I also wanted to say that a big part of the Philadelphia holding out as long as they did was because Andre Blake was also good. So great performances by unheralded goalkeepers. I know Blake is the starter at Philadelphia, but rescue these goalkeepers. If you're a team elsewhere in the league that isn't so sure what's going on, what you want to do next time the window opens, rescue these goalkeepers, please.
Yeah,
please.
No, absolutely. And that's the thing you forget about sometimes is that some of the best players are ones that you don't ever see. They're just waiting for that opportunity. Two games that I don't have a ton to say about and I kind of lumped together a little bit. Orlando San Jose, I was not surprised by the result. I was surprised by the number of goals and how bad the defending throughout the game was. There was a lot of talk about different calls. It ended 3-2 and Orlando won the game. To me, this was a fair result, and I was actually surprised that San Jose was able to fight back as well as they did as late into the game as they did. But the major note I just put here was, like, I put out a poll on Twitter on Saturday, I believe, late Saturday, to say, who was the worst defense of the weekend? Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, or Orlando and San Jose together?
Well, you can really rip open a... if there's anything this weekend showed, is that you can, between Colorado and between this in San Jose, you can really rip open a defense in this league with some great, well-placed long passes. If you, and that takes a little bit of preparation for everybody to know what the score is and to begin the counterattack, but if they're not thinking defense, if they're not thinking back checking, if they're having a high press and you can take control of the ball at the right time, you could just tear a team wide open.
Mm-hmm. You sure can. And I've begun to look at it more as the collective four, because that's what a defense should be. but it's not just about center backs. It's not just about fullbacks. It's about how the four line up together and how they cover for each other. That we've seen the good teams, and I think Dallas has done this very well. It's just been a little bit more organized, and players know that you need to be coming in and covering for people when they're out of position. But just to only have two players back, most MLS teams like to press very, very high with their fullbacks. Mm-hmm. And that's okay, but it does mean then that your wingers, if you're playing the overlap, they need to be the ones that are getting back and covering in the space. It doesn't mean that you just have two center backs at the back hoping to stop a rush of four players. But it is said the counterattack has proved deadly for a number of teams, and this game was certainly exciting for a number of reasons, but was a little bit sort of like watching a tennis match of... not a tennis match in the terms of them trading goals, but the first half we had all Orlando, and they looked like the better team by far. They start the second half with another brilliant goal from Dom Dwyer, and then they just completely switch off and lose focus, and all of a sudden San Jose look like they're back into it, and Youngworth gets two goals, and there's honestly a moment sort of like in added time, and I forget San Jose's coach's name, but he sort of like all of a sudden switches on of like, oh shit, we could get a point here. And now and he just becomes so animated.
Whoa.
In the 90th minute. Oh, wait, we're playing a game here. My main takeaway from this game was whoever the, you know, we talk about British commentators and...
Oh my God, yes, yes.
American commentators.
Oh, I
British commentators
too.
Go over. First of all, they're not sure quite what gender... Dom Dwyer's baby is. And second of all, they just, in the most passive aggressive sexist way, are like, oh, and there's his wife. Who, and she's just like so recognizable as well. Down
like,
on the pitch.
Yeah,
you're like,
one
it's
of the,
fucking
one of,
Sydney LaRue.
One of the biggest stars of the U.S. women's national team.
Just, you know, one of the biggest stars of the U.S. women's national team. No big deal. Just the wife. I was like,
who picked a fight with Portland last week? It was a Merritt Paulson picked a fight with. Well, no, not picked a fight. Merritt Paulson picked a fight with her over whether or not she could take her kids out of the pitch after the game. That
it's
was
just so fucking sad. Sometimes, man, it's just so depressing when you really.
Oh, that was with the Thorns. That was an NWSL.
Yeah, but you just realize sometimes that, like, and I mean. Obviously, I'm saying this with a ton of privilege and trying to pull the wool off of the eyes. It's like, just how disrespected women athletes are in this world. That, like, you can literally be one of the best in your country and the announcers have no idea who the fuck you are. You're just a woman holding a baby on the side of the pitch.
And this is especially, like this isn't acceptable anywhere. And it wasn't, I kept joking when the Philadelphia Eagles were in the Super Bowl that I didn't care what whoever Mr. Ertz was,
right?
It was Julie Ertz. I was cheering for whatever team Julie Ertz was affiliated with. But it's especially like you could say it in other sports. Oh, well, we don't know, you know, the NWSL doesn't have a high profile, whatever. There's no excuse to be in the soccer community and not know who some of these key players are. Because
we're not talking about some unknown or some rookie that, you know, there's just not enough exposure and okay, they're British and they don't know, like, this would be like Alex Morgan's at a match and you're just like, who's that lady? What's she doing? She's all right, isn't she?
I was going to call it something else though, for the commentary from that game. You're not a big fan of Dave Johnson of DC United, whose birthday it was last week. His "it's in the net" call.
It's in the net. It's in the net.
It's in the net. They put out a little video where all the players were doing their version of the call. It was cute. But Chris Miller scores in the whoever the commentator it is, a very gravitas heavy older white guy yells, "Straight cash, homie." No thanks. I'm gonna say no thank you on that one.
Oh, soccer's still so painfully white sometimes when it comes to the commentators and popularized fan base. What else we got? Oh, Seattle did what they do, or used to do, against Minnesota. Minnesota's still struggling to find answers. I feel like Minnesota's getting ragged on a little bit. I don't know if I just feel sorry for them for their underdog position. Seattle takes it 3-1. Do you have any particular thoughts about this match?
I missed this one in the highlight playlist in the MLS YouTube account. It wasn't listed, so I didn't get to. I didn't see it, but it's with Minnesota. It's still continuing to be a project. They're kind of one of those more Vancouver early years teams than they are an Atlanta or a Seattle. So
they are, and I agree to a certain extent. The thing for me is still that, you know, they're without Kevin Molino for the whole season. They've looked good at points. This, to me, was a little bit more about Seattle coming together and finally switching on. Yes. As opposed to Minnesota not being great, although Minnesota has been guilty of starting games quite slowly, and that seems to still be a trend. But there was quite a good bit of link-up play with Christian Ramirez, who did eventually get a goal to make it 2-1 in the 66th minute. And then just Jordi Delem in added time just sort of pops one in on a kind of nothing ball. The only thing I really have from this one is Gustav Svensson is go back and watch that goal because he just fires an absolute rocket from at least 30 yards out. 20 yards out apparently. But really great. Will Bruin does his typical no-nonsense, non-artistic goal to make it 2-0. But it's good to see from Seattle, and I can say that as a MLS fan and not as a Whitecaps fan, that Seattle's finally starting to turn the screw a little bit and switch on. And I think that's got to be a relief to Sounders fans who really felt like they've been hard done by this season and have taken an awful long time to get started. But if they can continue to just sort of stick to their roots and do what they do well, I think that's going to pay off for them.
Yeah, no doubt. The thing I was looking to is, with Seattle was when you talk about Will Bruin, is the Will Bruin I think a lot of times last year when they looked I was really critical of putting Bruin up there alone, and I thought a lot of the times that they looked poorer was where they were in that formation. So I think the fact that they were able to put a result together like last week when they got the draw last week, I think, right? I had said that was usually when they're getting good results and bad results, the bad results were the ones where they were using that Bruin formation. Well, they finally started to be able to turn results using it, which is good because they obviously don't want to use Dempsey all the time, and they don't have Jordan Morris. So So they have to make it work.
They do. And also credit that Will Bruin is putting in the work and making it work. Mm-hmm. I think it's the ideal position for him in many ways. And, you know, I think that sometimes we talk about the straightforward, no-nonsense, not particularly gifted strikers with a little bit of derision. We want to see the really, really pretty goals. But for me, he's just one of those classic MLS strikers where, like, he's not great. But Will Bruin, regardless of what team he's ever played for, I mean, he's had some dips here and there. But sometimes that's the best thing, and you can't just shout at the sky all the time hoping for a simple play and simple goals when your team needs it most, and then shit on the guy when he delivers it. And Will Bruin is the guy that delivers that, of just gets into the right place and really is good at getting goal kind of out of nothing. And it might be a sloppy pickup play, but mm-hmm. it's a crucial goal that puts some momentum into them. And so far, he's started this season fairly well. Is he a Jordan Morris? Of course he's not. But that doesn't mean he's not going to be able to contribute. And if he continues to deliver, Svensson continues to deliver, and Dempsey's able to continue to do what he does, I think we're going to see a Seattle that's going to maybe not quickly climb the table, but they'll continue to rack up points off of a disappointing start to the season.
And as you look at, you know, Seattle and Toronto are the teams that whose destinies seem forever linked, and they're starting their ascent first. So I guess Toronto already had a win, but if this is now the turnaround, they're beginning that first. The other thing that I was looking at was this LA Galaxy Atlanta game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of goals, a lot of penalty kicks. Probably the goofiest Panenka attempt I've ever seen from Josef Martinez. So the Panenka is a type of penalty kick where you, instead of kicking it with speed and finesse, you take a little step and you kick it very softly, probably through the center or something, in an attempt to try and make the goalkeeper dive early and then, you know, have your pick of the litter. Well, Martinez jumps to make this delay. And because he jumps, the goalkeeper dives where he's obviously going, and he can't change directions because he jumped.
Yeah, that was a bit of a head scratcher.
It Martinez bounced off the pole, and it didn't happen for him.
I can't remember who it was. It might have been Nick Dozovich or one of the Canadian commentators said a couple of weeks ago that Atlanta United also leads the league in questionable neck tattoos. But Martinez strikes me as a player that, fuck it, when he's good, but my God, he's just got a little bit more hair and neck tattoos than brain sometimes, and makes life awfully difficult for himself. And the ego on that guy, I mean, if we want to talk about egos in MLS, I think Martinez is pretty much unparalleled. That it's just like, mate, get your boot through it and stick it away. For me, this is a game that was supposed to have a lot of fireworks. I predicted this result and loaded up on Atlanta players in my fantasy team because I thought that they'd come away with a win because Almiron's been in such good form. Atlanta really needed to put this one to bed much sooner and still look to be a team that just hesitates a little bit too much or tries to be a little bit too fancy. That being said, it's working for them more often than not, and it certainly worked this night. They need to be a little bit more clinical. Martinez needs to get his head out of his ass, but ultimately, you know, when Zlatan first came to LA Galaxy, we both said he's going to score some amazing goals and he's also going to have a lot of real long nights in MLS, disappointed that he's playing against teams and playing with a team that is not always going to match his expectations and what he's played with. And this was a perfect example of he really did not have a look at goal all night long, and Atlanta were well up to the challenge and I think set the bar for how you defend against Zlatan and how you defend against a team that loves to attack. And all of LA's former issues kind of came back to haunt them in this match, that there just never really seemed to be quite that much on for them. There's a couple calls here and there, but for me, it was actually Atlanta should have put this one to bed a little sooner, and credit to them for finally doing it and getting the win.
I'll be a little softer on Martinez. I'm not against a sassy Panenka. Don't get me wrong. against a sassy Panenka, but the goal with it is to, which I think is that's Toddy's thing, right? Is to have this sort of, it's a sly move. It's not actually a showy move. It's a cool guys don't look at explosions move.
Right. Yeah.
Where you
good point.
You're hanging back to let other people move first, but the way that he executed it was so full of energy that he was the first mover, and it was easy to sort of shut him down. Now, he did score that second goal, and this is, I think, in terms of it took them too long to get that second goal, or it took them too long to nail the game down. It was another one of those situations where when it's even, and when you are finally able to score, you can change the game. Even with just one goal, you can change the game in your favor a little bit.
I agree. The last match of the week that we had seemed like it took forever to come because it was late on Sunday. Portland versus New York City FC. Now,
I was probably in my late night fever dream writing my column about Kansas City.
Fair enough. Because of our Skype connection, I briefly thought you said beaver dream instead of fever dream, but
that's fine.
same. We're Canadians. In the Canadian context, I thought you meant beaver dream. I had a feeling before this match that it would be tightly contested, but for doing it for the fantasy points,
that didn't happen, huh?
Loaded up a couple of New York City FC players, and therefore I'm taking full credit for Portland finally getting off the mark and doing something and defeating arguably one of the best teams in MLS right now. Well, not arguably, one of the best teams in MLS right now, defeating them 3-0 quite handily.
Wow.
What do you, like, is this so just again, a total head scratcher or kind of an inevitable thing that happened?
So again, I slept through this and they didn't add it to the highlight reel. So I didn't get a chance to see it, but when you're looking at these stats, they put here the completion of nearly 800 passes, the full number is around here somewhere. Yeah, like 800 passes, almost 800 passes, 91% accuracy, possession of 74.6%. 74.6% and you lose 3-0? Like, which team? I was noting, I was trying to work out whether or not it was a first half, second half thing. I think it was LAFC had 26 shots this week, but like the shots are even two.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 11-12. They got the same amount of shots in. How do you get in 11 shots and have 25% possession?
By New York City. This is why they've been so good and continue to be so good, is that they're a very versatile team. We've seen them play really well against the Western teams, really well against the Eastern Conference teams, because they can adapt to different systems, and they can be a team that controls possession and win 1-0, and they can be a team that has 25% possession and win 3-0. This just didn't quite land for them, and this was one of those things where we saw finally all the pieces fell into place for Portland, and all of a sudden they're the very difficult side to play against that we've seen so often. What we've talked about them missing this season, all their major players for the most part stepped up, So completing nearly 800 passes, that's also fifth best since Opta began tracking the data in 2010. So all of a sudden, like, clearly whatever training drills they've been working on in terms of moving the ball, that's New York City FC's, not Portland's. This has been New York City's strength, is just moving the ball around at will. But Portland has kind of begun to come back to that patience that they've had at times, where rather than sit back too much and absorb pressure to the point where you're giving up goals, they've just been slyly waiting for their chances. And interestingly, played a very Whitecaps game. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sebastian Blanco comes off the mark. Fernando Addy gets another goal.
What, 16 fouls? Is that the Whitecapsy part? Sorry.
No. The Whitecapsy part is not bothering if you have the ball at all and somehow still scoring a goal. This, for me, is not, it's not going to endear me to anybody, but my team of the week for the second week in a row is Portland Timbers. I thought that they were by far the most clinical team this weekend. The only reason why I'm not giving it to Sporting KC is because clearly at a certain point that game was completely over, and I really don't think they had much of a challenge to begin with. But Portland Timbers, to have this kind of result, considering the way that they've played against this team with so little possession, the odds were absolutely stacked in their favor, and this was not luck. I thought that tactically they got this game absolutely perfect and showed what they can do. It's a case now of, can they continue to do this? But they've got something to build on.
I'm going to give my team of the week to Houston. Because because the thing is, they've been doing okay. I know that this is legitimately not MLS opposition that they're playing against.
Right.
But
they're effectively playing a USL side.
Every time you step into this situation, it's a banana peel move. And they took their opportunities.
Yes.
I think that that's something that I can really say in their favor is that you don't get many of these. You don't get many of these days when you're playing Toronto. And they used that to have a very emphatic performance at home. And I think that will be some result, can be a real turning point. I know that in the season, and I'm thinking specifically of a very dire 0-0 draw 3 years ago between the Whitecaps and Houston. As one of them, that can just sort of a win or a loss can send you spiraling one way or another. And regardless of the players that are in the jersey, being able to record a 5 goals against Toronto is special and is something that you could take with you into the future weeks of the season.
I agree. If they can continue to ride that momentum, Houston needed this one. And as we said with Colorado last week, as I think it was last week, against the same side, although a different same side, different again from the different same side this weekend, is that you still have to finish it. So just because you're playing against a weakened side doesn't mean shit. Also, the Whitecaps found that out against RSL. You got to finish it. And Houston took their chances, played this game very professionally. They knew that they'd be playing a weakened side going in for sure. And rather than sit back and rather than not attack the play, they did that. And it's great training, right? Like it's great to get those early points in the season, and then they can look back at this and use this to see what kind of team they can be. It's a whole different story if, you know, they win 2-1, which they could have done easily. But rather than do that, they really stepped it up and continued to turn on the gears. So I think it's a good pick for... I don't disagree with your pick.
Now, and I definitely think you're right about Portland, because ultimately this is another rehabilitation case like Seattle. And New York was not playing in a USL side. So to not only win, but to win so handily, can only be positive.
Indeed.
What was your goal of the week / player of the week?
Okay, I think I have two different ones here for this.
Yes.
Goal of the week, I'm going to give to Gustav Svensson. Just a nice, simple little screamer. It's been a long time coming. I thought it was a great goal. There were certainly lots of great goals this weekend, but I thought that was the one that really mattered. Svensson came off, pulled it off, and it was ultimately the goal that got Seattle going, and I think ultimately is the game winner. Is Seattle has just struggled to score goals and do much of anything. Uh-huh. Svensson has been part of that criticism. That's my goal of the week. My player of the week... Well, you do your goal of the week, and I'll do my player of the week.
I'm giving it to Kitaj. I lost his first name. It's not Chris Kitaj. It's Chris Kattan. the New England player who began... who started things off in that game with a very pretty goal. Mm-hmm. The Chicago player. In Chicago really were kind of my runner-up for Team of the Week because of the way that they were able to string something together there, too. Just a
Alexander Kitaj.
A great finish from Alexander Kitaj.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great goal. It's better than my goal pick, but I just wanted to mix it up. Can't always pick the volley, you know? Who's your player of the week? And I want you to go first, because I just want you to go first.
All right, let me look at my notes here really quick. My player of the week. I think I know
no. What you're gonna do. Did we pick the same person, and do we not want to say it after all of that?
No, I think we got to do it. I think we got to do it because...
Okay, let's do it on three, and there's a slight, like, minuscule second delay because we're on Skype, but let's do it on three. We'll say first and last name of our pick of the week.
Three, one, two,
oh, wait.
Three.
Johnny Russell.
Johnny Russell.
Fuck, It's Johnny Russell. We had the same pick anyway, so...
Well, I mean, like, Piatti, my thought was going to be you, and I realized that it was going to be Johnny Russell for you, was that, Piatti scored a hat-trick, too, and then I was like, well, it didn't fucking matter in that game, so there's no, another player scored a hat-trick this week, and there's still no way to argue out of Johnny Russell was the best player of the week.
I really feel like this is one where I go... And also, perhaps he should have been sent off for quote-unquote instigating that. And maybe he did. I'm really trying to not just play the Glaswegian angle here that, you know, a boy from Glasgow, I'm always going to take the side of and the hot-headed Scotsman coming over and busting up a play. But that first goal, and then the second goal, he just...
Yeah, before even the fracas, there were two great goals from him.
Yeah, and he's not a striker necessarily either. Like that's the other thing. Like this is if you want to talk about MLS signings that you know are not big names that you're bringing in for a ton of dough, they found a really great player who fits really well into their system. And love him or hate him, there's no question he's the player of the week.
There's an interesting balance between being vocal, and we've got all kinds of Scottish players like this before, being vocal and being overbearing, being emotional and being out of control. I think that it all comes down to how it's perceived, but certainly he's been a leadership figure.
He has been, and really that's been the strength of him in the last couple of games, or in the last few weeks, is that he's stepped out and done something and picked his team up and given them something to rally against, and that's the kind of on-field leadership you want to see. further down the line, yeah, I anticipate a few red cards for the chap or accumulation of yellows for getting a little bit too emotional and emotionally invested in things. But yeah, for now, yeah, come on. It sucks. I'm not just trying to shit on the Whitecaps and rub salt in the wounds, but there's no question to me that he's the player of the week and is flying high right now. The discipline thing, I think he's got to watch. I think that could really hurt Sporting Kansas City if he's not able to quite get that under control, because other referees would have sent him off for flying into that like he did. And it's not a thing you want to see happening week in, week out. But if you can score a hat trick, it's a good way to set your team up for success.
Yeah, and I mean, he's got a couple in the last few weeks too, so you've got to believe that he's somewhere on the league scoring charts in this young season. Before we go, do we have time for this? Why not? Do the standings matter? Do the standings matter yet?
Okay, is this because you saw one of the top stories on MLSsoccer.com? LAFC for the Supporter Shield? No,
I didn't see that.
Don't fucking matter right now. Like, yes. Yeah, let's call it right now. Let's call it now. Ugh. You just want to rip your hair out sometimes.
Well, we'll talk about those standings when they matter then. In the meantime, when can we find you online? Where can we find you online?
You can find
How
me
can we find you online?
On weekends. Midday, usually. After I've had my lunch. On Twitter, at That's So MLS, tweeting in despair down the dark hole of teams being terrible. But I've gotten a little more balanced these days. But anyway, this isn't about me. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com, littleriverpellets.com for my most recent column on this calamity that the Whitecaps have got themselves into. I'm an editor for Howler Magazine, www.howler.com. Please follow this podcast on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts and give us a rate, review, and subscribe.
Do those things. Cool. Well, until next time, don't get sent off, or your friend. If you've got a friend hanging out and he's there, don't have him sent off as well. Or if you're commentating a match, maybe do some research on the very notable sports celebrities that are standing on the sidelines.
You know,
sorry, Sydney LaRue. We know who you are.
You know, like after that whole Whitecaps conflagration, one of the other people got another coach got sent off. So I really think we're starting to. I'm really worried about you, Nick. We got to make sure you don't get sent off. They're sending anyone off now.
I just as a casual fan at an away game, I'm not even there and I could be sent off.
Yes.